Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is November the 11th, and we are in Parashas Beshalach, page 372, Pasuk.
23.
Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23.
372.
The Egyptians have followed the Jews into the sea. Vayudefu Mitzrayim vayavo'u achareihem. And the Egyptians chased and they came after them. Kol sus paro, all the horse of paro, all the horses of paro. Richbo, his chariots, ufarashav, and his cavalrymen. El tochayam, into the midst of the sea. Actually, it says here, parashav, or horsemen. Okay, into the sea. Vayhi b'ashmaras haboker, and it was at in the watch of the morning. The evening, the nighttime is broken up into three or four watches, which means sections. The Torah recognizes, just as when you would appoint guards over any place at night. So you're not going to have one guard watch the entire night. That's a very difficult thing to do. You're going to have a rotation. And the watches will rotate either every 3 hours or every 4 hours. Either you'll have three watches or four watches through the night. The watch that is right before morning is called Ashmores HaBoker, the watch of the morning. It's the nighttime, but it is the nighttime watch that precedes the morning. It's the last watch of the night. The Torah recognizes the night having several sections. So it was in the watch of the morning, the one right before morning. Vayashkef Hashem amachane Mitzrayim, and Hashem literally means that he looked down on the Egyptian army, the Egyptian camp. Be'amud esh ve'anan, with a pillar of fire and cloud. So here that fire and cloud that the Jews had been using, that had benefited the Jews so much, now this fire and cloud becomes a weapon that attacks the Egyptians. Vayaham es machane Mitzrayim, and it confused or confounded the camp of the Egyptians. The Rashi cites that our sages tell us the cloud came down first and caused the ground to become very muddy, so that the Egyptians, where the Jews were going through an area that was paved, it wasn't actually paved, but it was dry, and it was the ground was smooth and it was not wet. So they were able to go very easily, walk very easily. Whereas the Egyptians, the cloud came down and made the area very muddy under their feet. And so the chariots, the wheels of the chariots began to roll through mud. Then the fire came down and heated the ground and dried it out, so that the ground was now full of ruts and bumps, and it caught the wheels of the chariots, and the wheels of the chariots came off. And the hooves of the horses got caught as well, and they lost their horseshoes or whatever it is they were using to be able to run easily, and it made the going very, very difficult and very bumpy, and it caused a general confusion amongst the army of the Egyptians. Vayasar Esau Fanmar Kevosav, and it removed the wheels of his chariots. Vayenahagehu Bichveidus, and Hashem dealt with them. Literally means with heaviness. In the English here it says with difficulty, but the literal translation is with heaviness. Vayomer Mitzrayim, and the Egyptians said, Anusa mipnei Yisrael, I will run from before the Jews. I will run away from the Jews. Ki Hashem milcham lahem, because Hashem is fighting on their behalf, b'mitzrayim, in or against the Egyptians. B'mitzrayim literally means in Egypt. Chazal tell us that just as the Egyptians who were in the midst of the sea were now being attacked by Hashem with this pillar of cloud and fire, this is before the water comes in to drown them, so too Hashem was also attacking the Egyptians that were back in Egypt. Simultaneously, the Egyptians back in Egypt were also being attacked and beaten by Hashem. It does not say what the method was, but we can surmise that just as a cloud and fire was used here, a cloud and fire was used in Egypt as well. Perhaps houses were burning, perhaps people were getting caught in mud. Whatever it is, the Egyptians, both at the sea and at home, were now getting attacked by Hashem. When it says that Hashem dealt with them with heaviness, bichveidus, Rashi says that this was midah keneged midah, was measure for measure, because earlier we saw, before Hashem hardened the heart of Paro, it says, vayachbeid libo, and he made his heart heavy, Paro made his heart heavy, hu va'avadav, he and his servants. They made their heart heavy, which means, what is a heavy heart? A heavy heart, generally, in the language of the Torah and of Chazal, generally means a certain laziness. An inability to change is a heavy heart. It's hard to move. There's a sense of being lethargic. So in the context of a person who is expected to change and they don't, that's a heavy heart. We know that laziness is not a good midah, it's not a good trait. And one is supposed to be, instead of lazy, one is supposed to be a zariz. One is supposed to be quick, excited, energetic in their service of Hashem. But Hashem did create the midah, the character trait of laziness. It does exist. And one may ask, where is that appropriately applied? Since we do have it within us, we can all be lazy. When is that meant to be applied? In the Mesillas Yesharim, in the Path of the Just, he writes that the midah of atzlus, of laziness, should be applied when one's yetzer hara, one's evil inclination, is working to get them to do something they should not be doing. The yetzer hara, my inclination, is trying to get me to go to a place that I really shouldn't go to. Or it's trying to get me to talk to somebody that I really shouldn't talk to because I know that I'll speak inappropriate things. Or it's in general trying to get me to do an action that I really shouldn't do. In those cases, so that's where you want your laziness trait to kick in. That's where you want to say, you know, I really don't want to get off the couch right now. I'm very comfortable. I'd rather not get up. That's where you want it to kick in. The laziness is a good thing to use when what's driving a person is something inappropriate. Then laziness is a good thing. So that when Paro and his servants did not allow themselves to be affected by the makos, by the plagues, and they maintained their position, there was a certain stubbornness, of course, but there was also a vayach beid libo, there was a heaviness, which means there was a certain laziness. They didn't allow themselves to become excited or energetic over the makos, over the plagues. They allowed themselves to be apathetic, despite the fact that the plagues were such terrible things, which should have gotten them to act. So that was a kvedus, it was a heaviness. So here, Hashem also deals with them with heaviness. He makes things difficult for them, and the language is that he dealt with them with heaviness. The Egyptians, when they enslaved us, treated us very, very badly, of course. And we know that one of the most terrible things that they did is that they drowned the Jewish boys, the Jewish baby boys. And here, there's going to be a midah keneged midah, measure for measure, the Egyptians are going to get drowned themselves. And it's going to be paid back much worse because of all the years of enslavement, and they're all going to get killed here at the sea. But in addition to what they did to the baby boys, there was a great deal of suffering that was imposed on the Jews by the Egyptians, with, as it says before in Parashat Shmos, bechomer uvilvanim, with mortar and with bricks. There was just a lot of heavy labor, and the labor didn't just mean carrying things. There was working with hot objects in with hot ovens where people got scalded and burned, and where people got trampled, and people got degraded and demeaned in many ways. People lost limbs during the work because of the conditions were not safe. Exhaustion. There were many different whippings. there are many different types of suffering that we Jews endured at the hands of the Egyptians. Here at the sea, the Egyptians are going, as we just read now, and then we'll read in a few verses, they were beaten in many different ways. And it was all mida keneged mida, it was all measure for measure. They were thrown to the ground, they were bounced around, they lost limbs, they were slapped, they lost teeth, they were burned by the fire. There were a lot of different things going on over here, scalded, a lot of things happening to the Egyptians, and it was all measure for what they did to us. So even prior to their being drowned and killed through the drowning, there is a lot of pain and suffering that's happening to the Egyptians here that is a measure for measure of what they did to us. And this is partially what is meant in the Haggadah. We're going to talk about it soon, that, and we've mentioned it before, that if you recall, that the Makos, the plagues, were Etzba Elokim, were a finger of God. We're going to see in a moment that the experience on the sea is Yad, is the hand of Hashem. A hand is five fingers, it's five times the Makos. So that means it's a minimum of 50 different plagues or 50 different ways of suffering that Hashem inflicted on the Egyptians at the sea. Others learn, if you remember from the Haggadah, it's one of the technical parts of Maggid, that some say it was 50, some say it was 200, and some say it was 250, depending on how you understand the math and the mathematical equation over there. Whatever it is, on the sea, there were multiple ways that the Egyptians were beaten. And it was all to pay them back for the way that they treated us when we were their slaves. So it wasn't just the drowning. And it wasn't just what I mentioned before. That was just a sampling of what happened at the sea. Many, many, some of them were buried alive in the way that the mud opened up and they fell in and the mud covered them, just like they did to the Jews. There were many different things that happened at the sea to the Egyptians, even prior to the water, that was to pay them back for what they did. And as we know, not only did it happen at the sea, but it happened to the Egyptians who remained back in Egypt. And that's what it means, Nilcham Lahem b'Mitzrayim, that God is fighting on their behalf against in Egypt itself. One more observation. In Pasuk Chafein 25, Mitzrayim, the Egyptians say, I will run, I will flee from before the Jews, for Hashem is fighting on their behalf against the Egyptians. They recognize for the first time that the Jews and Hashem are one. That if you attack the Jewish people, you are attacking Hashem. And if you attack Hashem, you are attacking the Jewish people. And when you attack the Jewish people, Hashem is going to attack you back. Now, we don't always see it in our day. We don't always see it. But it is a fact. When someone raises their hand against the Jews, they are considered raising their hands against Hashem. And Hashem will ultimately repay that person for what they have done. And the Egyptians finally recognize it here. You see, we pointed out last time that the Egyptians running after the Jews into the sea was nothing short of insane. After, just to reiterate what we said last time, after all they endured at the hands of the Jews, of Hashem, after all they endured with all the plagues, the way they were beaten and they suffered and they lost all their livelihood and then people were killed, and now they think they have the Jews trapped, and all of a sudden the pillar of cloud gobbles up the arrows and the stones that they shoot at the Jewish people, and the fire is there to protect the Jewish people and to lead the Jewish people. And then the sea opens up into 12 corridors that are beautifully paved and lined with fruit growing from the sides, and it's just a very pleasant way for the Jews to travel through. They have to be insane to follow the Jewish people in. What were they thinking? What we know is going to happen in the end, that they're going to get drowned. Wouldn't any sane person realize that if this is a miracle that's happening for the Jewish people, it's just as easy for Hashem to reverse that miracle and drown the Egyptians? Why would the Egyptians be safe and the Jews not be safe. So we said that Hashem hardened their heart and they ran in after the Jewish people. But even in the face of hardening their heart, what were they thinking? They had to be thinking something. It wasn't simply blinders that okay, we're just gonna go in without thinking at all. What they must have thought something, the Egyptians, as they chased the Jewish people into the sea. They were angry, to be sure, and when a person is angry, they don't think straight. But still, they were also just beaten so badly in Egypt over the whole year with 10 plagues to forget the whole thing and run in after the Jewish people. They had to have some rationale. However far-fetched the rationale is, there must have been something playing on their minds that made them believe that this was not a dangerous thing to do, to run in after the Jewish people into the ocean. So it seems to me that it's also possible that, see, from the very beginning, the whole approach of the Egyptians, and we touched on this several times before, was a question of who is the main nation of the world. The world revolves around which nation? We know the world revolves around us Jews. The Egyptians believed that the world revolved around them. This was the whole issue of Bechor, of firstborn. The firstborn, the birthright, the Egyptian position was, we are the Bechor, we are the firstborn of humanity, and we are the ones around whom the rest of humanity revolves. The Jews, we Jews know that we are the Bechor. As Hashem says to tell Paro at the outset, Bini Bechori Yisrael, my son, my firstborn is the Jews. They are the firstborn. As from Yaakov, we're the firstborn. The Makas Bechoros, the death of the firstborn Egyptians, was to send that message home, to make it very clear. That's why they lost their firstborn. Why wasn't the punishment they should lose anyone? Every family should lose one member. The strongest member of the family, the tallest member of the family, whatever, the smartest member of the family should die. Why does it have to be the firstborn? Because they revered the firstborn, because they held themselves to be the firstborn of humanity. And Hashem was making it clear, no, my Jews are the firstborn of humanity, and you are not. It was a very clear message sent to the Egyptians. Here, when they're chasing after the Jewish people, Paro has managed to revive in the Egyptians this sense of supremacy, the sense that they are the ones for whom the world exists. Now remember, we're talking about people who the supernatural was natural. They had black magic in Egypt. There was much kishuf going on in Egypt, much black magic. And this was not uncommon. Now, what happened at the sea was nevertheless far greater than anybody had ever witnessed before. It put all of their black magic to shame. Nevertheless, the Egyptians could have deluded themselves into believing that this was not for the Jews, but for them. Because one could argue, if one is the pursuer, and now the sea opens up, and it's beautiful, and it's paved nicely, and there's food on the sides, perhaps this is a way of setting the table for the Egyptians to vanquish the Jews. This is going to be our victory, in which we're going to slaughter the Jewish people, and we're going to reap the benefits, and a power is making this happen, is doing it for our sake, that we are going to have an easy time of it. It's paved beautifully. There's food for us to eat as we pursue our enemies. And it's all laid out before us. We're going to drive them into the sea, to quote a more contemporary evil man, and we'll drive them into the sea, and we will enjoy the experience in the sea. They could have deluded themselves into thinking it's not for the Jews that this is all set up, but it's for us that it's all set up. And they then descend into the sea, and when they finally are down in the sea, then it all changes. Then all of a sudden, all of that beautifully laid out table becomes a mess for them. It becomes the worst mistake they've ever made. The ground becomes a quagmire. They begin to be bounced around. There's fire and there's mud and there's just all kinds of pain and suffering that's happening to them in this area of the sea. And the water is all around them, and at any moment it could collapse on their heads. And now they're terrified. Now they're being beaten. The Jews, meanwhile, just a little bit ahead of the Egyptians, are still walking peacefully on a very nicely paved area with the fruits growing on the side and the water, the fresh water to drink, and just the beauty of the water. Imagine going through with, you know, with the sea on either side, being able to see the fish. It's the ultimate aquarium experience, right? Right. So the Jews had it great, only a little bit ahead of the Egyptians. But where the Egyptians were, it was falling apart. The whole thing was just falling apart all around them. Pasuk Chavah, verse 26. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe. Hashem said to Moshe, "Tei yaskadcha al hayom, stretch your hand over the ocean. V'yashuvu hamayim al Mitzrayim, and the water will return on the Egyptians, al Rechbo, on his chariots, val Parashav, and on his horsemen." Notice it doesn't say that the Jews came out of the ocean yet. Mm-hmm. Right? They will, but they were not necessarily on the other side yet when this happens. Vayet, they were safe. Nothing happened to the Jewish people. But it could be that the drowning of the Egyptians began even as the Jews are still in the ocean. Just as the previous part with the fire and the mud and all that took place while the Jews were still in the ocean. Same thing over here. Vayet Moshe esgado al hayam. Moshe stretched out his hand over the ocean. Vayashav hayam lifno spoker. And the ocean returned towards morning, la'esano, to its strength, to the way it was before. As the morning is dawning, the water now returns to the way it was. Umitzrayim nasim likraso, and the Egyptians were traveling to meet the water, where the Egyptians had become so confused with the way they were being buffeted around that they were actually traveling further into the ocean rather than out of it. Vayina'er Hashem es Mitzrayim b'sol chayam, and Hashem drowned the Egyptians in the ocean. Vayashuvu hamayim, and the water returned. Vayechasu es harechev ves haparashim, and it covered the chariots and the horsemen. V'chol chel paro, to all of the army of paro, haboim acharehem bayam, that were coming after them in the ocean. Lo nishar bahem ad echad, there were none left until there were... Now the English translation is, there remained not a one of them. There remained not a one of them. It can also be read, that it did not remain of them until one. Mm-hmm. Because we know one did survive. Yeah. And that is Paro. Uvinei Yisrael, and the Jews, now this is almost a verbatim... what's that? Well, no. Oh. This is almost the exact same pasuk we had before in Chafez in 22. Uvenei Yisrael halchu vayabasha b'sol chayam, and the Jews went on the dry land into the ocean. V'hamayim lahem choma, and the water was for them a wall. Miminam u'mismalam, on their right and on their left. So evidently the Jews were still in the ocean as the Egyptians are being drowned.
Vayosha, a wall for them.
What's that?
There was a wall.
Yeah, well, the water was a wall. Right.
The water was a wall.
Vayosha Hashem bayom hahu es Yisrael miyad Mitzrayim, and Hashem saved the Jews on that day from the Egyptians. Vayar Yisrael es Mitzrayim meis al svas hayom. That's a critical pasuk. And the Jews saw the Egyptians dead on the shore of the sea. So even though the Egyptians were drowned in the sea, but their bodies washed ashore. Vayar Yisrael es hayara gidolah, and the Jews saw the great hand, Asher Asa Hashem b'Mitzrayim, that the that Hashem had done against the Egyptians. Vayireu ha'ames Hashem, and the Jews, the nation feared Hashem. Vayaminu ba'Hashem, and they had faith in Hashem. Uv'Moshe avdo, and in Moshe his servant. In the Haggadah, one of the famous that we say on Pesach night, one of the famous observations about the Haggadah is that Moshe's name is not mentioned. It's all about Hashem. It is not about Moshe. If Moshe's name would be mentioned in the Haggadah, one may make the mistake and turn the Pesach Seder, the Pesach experience, into some sort of hero worship about Moshe. And that's not what it's about. It's about how Hashem took us out of Egypt. This verse is the only time Moshe's name is mentioned in the Haggadah. The Haggadah quotes this verse, and it says, we had faith in Hashem and in Moshe, his servant. This is the only time that in the Haggadah, this verse is where Moshe is mentioned in the Haggadah. Other than this, his name is nowhere to be found in the Haggadah itself. But it doesn't actually say we emerged from the sea. That is an interesting point. I think that, like you said, the common perception is like we made it out just in time.
Yeah.
You know, the water was up there and we got out and then it fell down right. But like the last, you can picture the last Jew, you know, exiting the sea, and then right behind them the water collapses. Right. That's right. But it doesn't seem that was the case. It seems that the Jews were still in the water on the dry land, walking, and the Egyptians are behind them and getting drowned.
That's the point. They're behind them. So it's starting back there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. The Jews were not rushing through. It wasn't like the thing was collapsing on them and they needed to rush and quickly get out of there before it fell on their heads.
In paintings, you always see them.
Decided the Jews were on.
Across the sea.
Yes. Well, there is a debate about exactly what happened over here. The common understanding is that the Jews crossed the arm of the Red Sea. They actually went across. And when they got to the other side, the Egyptian bodies also washed ashore on that side.
But from the other side and towards them, then it would.
Yeah, yeah. But the water was really all over, as we'll see. But there is at least one major commentary that says they never crossed. They went in a big arc and came back to the same side they started on, and then went over. You know, they just traveled by land to Har Sinai. So it's unclear, but it doesn't really matter. See, that's the thing. The purpose of this was not to get from one place to another. Mm-hmm. The purpose of this was to save the Jews and destroy the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. That was the purpose. That would be the rationale to understand it that way. They weren't going someplace. They were being saved from the Egyptians, and Hashem was dealing with the Egyptians the way he wanted to, in a public manner. As I mentioned before, this event is the greatest revelation of Hashem that the world has ever seen since the creation of the world, with the exception of Matan Torah, with the giving of the Torah itself. Other than that, this is the greatest revelation. This is the single most dramatic miracle that has taken place since the creation of the world, with the exception of giving of the Torah. Paro comes out of this and is forced to go back to Egypt, and because where else is he going to go? And he comes back. He comes back with nothing.
Right.
So he comes back. He's demeaned. I mean, he's just, no one has any respect for him anymore. He led the entire army against the Jews, and he comes back with absolutely nothing.
Is everybody in Egypt dead?
Not everybody in Egypt is dead. Hashem, what Hashem did to them is similar to what he did to the Egyptians prior to the drowning of the Egyptians. The drowning only took place at the sea. The ones in Egypt were not drowned. So they may have been beaten, they may have lost limbs, whatever happened to them over there, but they did not necessarily die. But remember, they were already whittled down by all the plagues. So we don't know how many Egyptians there were. Now, this is Pasuk Lamed, verse 30 is where it says, I'm sorry, Pasuk Lamed, verse 31, where it says the Jews saw the hand, the great hand. That is the way the Haggadah derives, that there were five times the amount of plagues at the sea than there were in Egypt. Because in Egypt it's the Etzba Elohim, the finger of God, and here it is the hand, the great hand of God. So it's five times what happened in Egypt. I want to contrast for you, this is not my idea, this is, they say this in the name of the Vilna Gaon, I want to contrast for you the verse 22, Chaf Beis, and Chaf Tes, verse 29. As I mentioned, they are almost the same verse. But there are a couple of nuances that are worthwhile noting. Chaf Beis 22 says, and the Jews entered the sea, they came into the sea. It says, Besel Chayam Bayabasha entered, they came to the sea on dry land. And the water was for them a wall on their right and on their left. In Chaf Tes 29, it says, and the Jews went on dry land into the sea. You notice the reversal? In 22, it says they went on dry land. They went into the sea onto dry land. And in 29, it says they went onto dry land into the sea. It reverses the two. And one other observation is that in Chaf Beis 22, it says the water was for them a wall. If you notice, the Hebrew word for wall is Ches Vav Mem Hey, Choma, which means a wall. In 29, the same word is there, Choma, but the Vav is missing. Now, it's still pronounced the same way because you can have an O sound, a Cholam, with a Vav or without a Vav. But the Vav is missing. It says Ches Mem Hey. They say in the name of the Vilna Gaon that these two psukim, these two verses, was a reference to two types of Jews who were at the sea. The first one, as we mentioned last week, was a reference to those Jews that had the faith in Hashem, that even though the water had not yet split, they were willing to go into the water knowing that Hashem was going to save them. Because Hashem said, go into the water. If Hashem says to go. We don't ask questions. And they went in, and that's why it says they went into the sea on dry land. First it was water, even as they were entering it, and only after they got into the sea, it turned into dry land. That was a reference to those who were faithful. On Chaf Tes 29, it says, and the Jews went on dry land into the sea. Those Jews who were on the fence and wanted to make sure it was safe before they traveled, they waited for the water to turn into dry land, and then they were willing to travel. Those Jews did not have the same kind of faith as the first ones. As a result, they say, in the name of the Vilna Gaon, the word choma in the first verse is spelled with a vav, which means a wall. The water was for them a wall. Whereas in the second verse, it says choma without a vav, because without a vav, ches mem hei can also be read chema. Chema means anger. That there was some level of anger, of disappointment in those Jews who did not have full faith. That even though Hashem said travel, they were not willing to travel until the water turned into dry land. They saw the Egyptians dead on the shore. The Gemara tells us the reason why this happened, the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, Tractate Sanhedrin tells us, the reason why this happened is because the Jews were scared. They were afraid that just as we are emerging from the water here, with this shore right here, and we don't see any Egyptians around, we're just emerging onto the water, everything is fine. Remember, the Jews had a very pleasant stroll through the ocean. And now they are coming out on dry land, everything is fine. They were concerned that perhaps the Egyptians also were emerging from the water, and they were also fine, maybe on the other side, maybe down shore a little bit, and they will turn around and attack us. So the Jews were still scared that they weren't yet safe, because they didn't see what happened. And therefore Hashem had the sea spit the Egyptian bodies out, literally spit them out, onto dry land, so that the Jews could see the Egyptians, and see that they were all battered and dead. And as Mrs. Starkman said, the Medrash says that the Jews were able to identify the Egyptians and were able to see the ones that had hurt them and identify those Egyptians and be vindicated in seeing what Hashem had done back to them. So the Egyptian that had whipped a Jew, the Jew would see that Egyptian with lacerations all over his body, seeing that he was whipped in return for having whipped me. The Jew who lost a limb at the hands of an Egyptian would see that particular Egyptian with that limb missing as well. The same way that they had done to the Jews were able to see in the Egyptians every blow that they had received at the hands of the Egyptians. They saw that same Egyptian with the same blow to that Egyptian. The Medrash says that the angel that is in charge of the ocean complained to Hashem and said, Hashem, you're taking away my bounty because I now have all these Egyptian soldiers that are corpses in the sea, and that is fodder for my fish. And you are now going to have me spit the Egyptian corpses up on the dry land, making them fodder for birds and animals. What about my fish? It's not fair. Since they were killed by the sea deserves to keep the bodies. To which Hashem responded, you're right, I will pay you back with interest. I'll pay you back 150%. And that in the future, there will be a prophetess named Devorah, and in her day there will be an evil man named Sisera who will bring an army that is 150% the size of the Egyptians, half the size larger than the Egyptian army, where the Egyptians had 600 chariots, the Sisera had 900 chariots, and they will come and attack the Jewish people. And in the midst of the fighting, I will bring Nachal Kishon. I will bring the river Kishon, which will flood will come down as a torrent. It will become a flood, and it will flood the army of Sisera, the Canaanim, and it will flood them down to the Red Sea, and all those bodies will end up in the sea, and your fish, the later generations of fish, will get the fodder that you wanted them to have now. That is a Gemara in Masechah Sanhedrin and Tractate Sanhedrin. Clearly, when you have a Gemara like this, the Gemara needs to be understood because it can't mean that there is some sort of a complaint, the way it's being said, that the angel in charge of the ocean complains to Hashem. The angel in charge of the ocean is nothing but a programmed robot that Hashem has put in charge of the ocean. There is an angel in charge of the ocean, but the angel is simply a servant of Hashem and does whatever Hashem tells it to do. It has no independent... it does think, but it doesn't have independent choice. It does whatever Hashem tells him to do. And the fact that many years later, hundreds of years later, what happens in the time of Devorah should be a payment for what happened now, it doesn't seem to connect. And furthermore, Hashem had a very good reason over here for having the bodies be spit out so the Jews could see the bodies dead. It was in order to give the Jews confidence that the Egyptians had been killed. What is meant by this? Well, later on, they'll be drowned. I mean, why does Hashem have to defend his choice, his decision? It was a good decision for the Jews' sake. So he asked to now give the fish food. The fish didn't die. They had what to eat. Hashem has to give them more food? What does that mean? So clearly, there is a connection that Gemara is trying to make between the two stories and to show that one leads to the other one, or one, a deficiency of one is made up by the other. The Gemara seems to be telling us that in the time of the Jews here at the sea, although they were saved, and although this is a generation that would now receive the Torah, but the Jews did have fear that the Egyptians were not killed. Now we can defend their fear. They were slaves, and they're being liberated from a nation that had enslaved them for over 100 years. The Jews, they have nightmares about these Egyptians, and it's very helpful for them to see the dead Egyptians. It can help. It's a very therapeutic. Thank you. A very therapeutic process. So we can understand that. But nevertheless, they were scared. They did not have full faith that the Egyptians had been destroyed. The Gemara seems to indicate that at the time of Devorah, the Jews then did not have this problem. They did not have this deficiency. That when they saw the water drown or inundate the army of Sisera, the Jews did not need to see the bodies. They had full faith that Hashem had saved them and had destroyed Sisera forever. And they were not afraid of those bodies. They had no doubt that the army of Sisera, the Canaanim, were dead. And they did not need to see the evidence in front of them. In the time of Devorah, that miracle is followed by the song of Devorah, Shiras Devorah. Shiras Devorah is sung then, and there are many parallels between Shiras Devorah, the song of Devorah, and Uz Yashir, the song of the sea, which we're going to have right now. Those two songs parallel each other very much. And there seems to be an element that happened in the time of Devorah that supersedes even what happens over here. So as we move on in understanding Uz Yashir, which is not going to be tonight, we'll start it next week, Mitzvah Hashem, we will also need to understand some differences and some similarities between this song and the song of Devorah, where the Jews were saved as well. Now, I understand that not everybody here is familiar with that story, and even those who are, perhaps not as in depth as we are with this story. That's okay. We'll just touch on certain points as we go through it. The Medrash and the Gemara tell us that when the Egyptians were killed by the water actually acted in many ways. That's correct. Right. The Haftorah, thank you very much. Dina is pointing out the Haftorah for Beshalach, for Parshas Beshalach, is Shiras Devorah. That's right. Is this a song of Devorah? That's right. This is the reason. They're very closely related. The Gemara tells us that when the Egyptians were drowned by the water acted in many ways that were different than what you might have expected water to do. And the property of water was a little different. And it served to, therefore, punish the Egyptians very specifically. Each Egyptian was punished independently based on his actions. So that we will see when we get to Uz Yashir that some Egyptians were drowned very quickly. And those would be the Egyptians that were the least evil. They died fast. There were other Egyptians that took longer to die, where the waves would throw them up into the air and they would crash back down, but Hashem wouldn't let them die. They would be just about to drown, and then they'd get some breath of air. And then, boom, they're back in the water again. So that to prolong the agony of the drowning because of what they did to the Jewish people. And the worst of the Egyptians, their agony went on the longest. For a very long period of time, they would be just about to drown, and then they get some air. And then Hashem would put them through it again. And then get some air. And put them through it again so that they would have the suffering for what they had done to the Jews. In addition to this, the water would sometimes be soft, as you expect water to be, that they would sink into the water, and sometimes the water would take on like an ice-like property, so that the Egyptians would bang into the water and it would feel hard, and it would be a smack as they were thrown around by the water. They weren't just killed, they were tortured, and they were scared. They were the fear as they were being buffeted around and beaten as they were killed.
Waterboarding.
Well, waterboarding is a choking sensation, right? This is a fascinating departure from the way Hashem might normally do things, because usually when it comes to evil people, Hashem does not punish them in this world. If a person is evil and they do not do teshuva, then usually or frequently Hashem lets them have all of the benefit of whatever good they've done in this world while they're in this world, so that when they get to the next world, there is no good to give them. There's nothing to repay them but bad, to punish them completely for all the evil they did in this world. Here with the Egyptians, it seems that Hashem wanted to make sure that each Egyptian was given their due, even in this world. The reason for this over here is not so much because Hashem wanted the Egyptians to have something good in the next world. The reason for this was because since this revelation was meant to be the greatest revelation of Hashem other than the giving of the Torah, therefore Hashem needed to show in this world what normally goes on in the next world. You see, the great equalizer is the next world. All the questions we have in this world, if that person is so righteous, why did they have such a rough life? If that person is so evil, why do they have such a great life? These questions, they bother us. Why do babies get sick? Why do babies die? These are things that bother us. We don't understand. And we're not meant to understand. There are certain things, human beings, they're beyond our capacity to understand. But when we get to the other side, everything is clear. Everything is clear. The other side, we are living in the Olam HaDimyon. We're living in the world of, Dimyon means imagination. It's not the real world. We think it's the real world, but the real world is really on the other side. The Olam HaEmes, the real world where you see everything clearly, where you understand everything, where even the Holocaust makes sense, is in the next world. But it's not here. Here we can't understand it. In the next world, we will. We'll understand everything. Everything. A revelation of Hashem means that things make sense. That's part of what it means for Hashem to reveal Himself. That the next world is brought into this world. The supernatural, the natural order is this world. The supernatural is the next world. It's a different order. And when Hashem is bringing the next world into this world, things have to make sense. And since things have to make sense, everybody has to get their due. Exactly the way a person acted, that's exactly what they're going to get back. And that has to happen here with the Egyptians as they are being destroyed. One last thing to mention, and we're going to stop with this, and we will mention this again as we move on. As the Egyptians were spit out onto the dry land, it wasn't just the Egyptians. It was their chariots and their dead horses and everything like that. They were all laden with gold and silver and all kinds of adornments. And the Jews benefited hugely from this. They not only saw the dead Egyptians, but they helped themselves to all of the spoils of war. The Jews didn't fight with the Egyptians, Hashem did. But Hashem destroyed the Egyptians on behalf of the Jews. And therefore the Jews were now entitled to the spoils of war. It is like the Jews defeated the Egyptians in battle, because Hashem is the warrior on behalf of the Jewish people. We're going to talk about that more in depth as we get through as Yashar and we go on after the show. Yes.
Where does it say that there was one in the Hebrew? Because it doesn't in the
Yeah, it's the very end of Chav Ches, the very end of 28. It says, Lo nishar bohem ad echad. In English it says, there remained not a one of them. But if you read it literally, it says, there did not remain amongst them until one.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.